matter of State versus Nathan Shaw. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Alexander Shalom from the Americans at Liberty Community of New Jersey as attorney.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. McLean.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve just 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
In this argument, I plan to first address inevitable discovery and then at the end discuss independent source, though I'm happy to switch the order of this.
That would be fine.
The police here illegally searched both a motel room and a car without a warrant. The state then tried to excuse the illegal police action by claiming that it was inevitable that the police would have lawfully gotten to this evidence. A year ago, this court remanded the case and gave the state the opportunity to try to save the illegal car search through application of inevitable discovery. The state chose not to present any evidence at the remand hearing and again failed to meet their high burden to save this unlawful search. The police's illegal actions and the state's failure to demonstrate a lawful alternative means of getting the evidence from the car should not be condoned by this court, and the evidence should be suppressed. So turning more generally to inevitable discovery, when discussing inevitable discovery, it's critical to keep in mind what this court recognized in Sugar, that the state must bear a high burden to justify what happened because the police actually violated the defendant's constitutional rights. And without firmly holding the state to this burden, there'd be no incentive for police to ever seek a warrant or otherwise comply with the Constitution. Turning to the prongs of inevitable discovery, I think the first two prongs are most applicable in this case, though I will also discuss the third one. Here, the state failed to demonstrate that the police would have actually followed their proposed lawful procedure of applying for a search warrant for the car, and further failed to demonstrate that it was inevitable that this hypothetical search warrant, which was based on the drug dog's alerts, would have been issued.
With regard to that, we have to start, I believe, with what evidence was lawful. What lawful evidence was there on which the police could act?
There is the tip from, or the phone call from the motel manager reporting that he found some kind of narcotics in the room. However, the officer is clear that there's no other description of what those narcotics are, and the officer himself testified that it could have been a bag of flour, it could have been a bag of sugar.
Okay, so that's all, so whatever he learned from going into the room has to be cut out, correct?
Correct, because the motel room search was plainly illegal. It was conducted without a warrant.
So is the only lawful evidence that the police officer learned from the motel manager, there may be narcotics there, and the police officer saying that I really didn't even know what was in there. Could have been flour, could have been sugar. That's
yes.
The testimony.
Yes.
But what is in the record about the manager's tip?
The manager says, essentially, he calls the police and says...
Can you be precise about it?
Yes, I can. One moment. The manager calls and says he found suspected narcotics under the... This is the first suppression transcript. Page 13. The motel manager said he believed he found a bag that contained some sort of suspected narcotics. And then the officers asked if he was given any more descriptive information about what those narcotics or suspected narcotics were.
What page is
it? That's the...
Whose testimony is this?
This is Officer Rademacher's.
So I'm looking at page 96 of the transcript, where they're reading into the record his statement. And he says, do you see it?
I do.
Is that that's the statement read into the record?
I mean, this is page 96?
Yes.
This...
On February 27th.
Yes. Yes, so...
That's for, from Patel's testimony.
That's from Patel's testimony, yes.
So his testimony before the grand jury was, as soon as I saw that, I didn't know what it was, so I called the police.
Yes.
I wasn't sure if it was drugs. Then an officer came in, and I took him to the room, and then we checked the room.
Yes.
And it doesn't... Did I read that correctly?
Yes, you are. I apologize. You were reading the record correctly.
And it doesn't seem, at least from the testimony that I've read, that the police officer asked any questions of the officer to get a description of what Patel had seen, the quantity of what he had seen, anything.
No, there's no information about what's in this motel room other than the motel manager believing it to be narcotics.
So give us what we have in the moment, so that we're not comparing apples to oranges.
At the moment of...
You have the manager reaching out.
You have the manager
tell us
reaching,
what the record is.
Yes, you have the manager reaching out saying, I found suspected narcotics, nothing more. We don't know what those are. Then, at the time of the car search, they find out that the renter of the motel room has a municipal arrest warrant from Irvington and a traffic ticket. And essentially, that's it. They stop the car. And then they go through this investigation maintain that's... There's no reasonable suspicion that there's drugs in the car.
So if you carved out everything that he learned in the room, and this is according to the testimony of the officer, he said, before I went into that motel room, I didn't know if I was going to find sugar or flour, would they have called in a drug dog? Is there clear and convincing evidence that they would have even called the drug dog with that limited evidence?
I don't believe that exists on this record, and the state hasn't augmented that record.
Do we consider what he said to the grand jury when it seems that what's critical is what he said to the police officers?
Correct.
And if I remember correctly, he didn't tell the grand jury exactly what he said to the police officer.
I'm sure he didn't use the exact same words, but I think the gist of it remains that he didn't describe what he saw. He didn't say, I saw a powder, I saw a vegetative substance.
Let me try to clarify what I'm saying. Shouldn't we look at what is the record as to what was the communication to the police officers, as opposed to more detail about what the manager saw as described to the grand jury? But the grand jury testimony is focused on what he saw as opposed to what he communicated to the police officers.
Yes, okay. So, yes, and what the suppression transcript that we have indicates that what was communicated to the officer is, I saw suspected narcotics. That's it.
Or what he believed to have
what
been.
What he believed to be
narcotics.
Right, and the officer, who is the experienced one, did not know what that meant.
Because he didn't ask for any descriptions. I'm looking at the transcript. Did he give you any more descriptive information? Not at that time. Because the officer didn't think that he had to. He thought he had a right to go into the motel room, so he wasn't asking questions of what it looked like, what was the quantity. He didn't ask any of those questions because he thought he could just walk in.
Yes, he believed he could, with the motel manager's permission, he believed he could enter that room without applying for a warrant, without any valid warrant exception.
So go back to the first prong and tell us why you don't think that's been met.
So the first prong contains two distinct inquiries. The first is that a specific lawful procedure exists and has been described by the state. And the next is that the state has to show that the police actually would have followed that procedure. Here, the state's chosen lawful avenue into this car is applying for a search warrant. And the only thing we know about this hypothetical search warrant is that it's based on the drug dog's alert. So that might be enough for the first half of the first prong. That is a specific lawful procedure. But there's no evidence on this record that the police actually would have done that, that they actually would have changed what they'd been doing up until this point and actually apply for a search warrant. In this case, as we've been discussing, the police had repeatedly failed to apply for a search warrant. The first officer walked into the motel room, and then he called his supervisor, who also walked in.
Can I ask you a question? Because did anyone testify whether or not they would have called for a drug dog based upon the limited information that Rademacher had before he walked into that motel room?
Not my recollection of the record of when they call for a drug dog is they testified that when someone refuses to consent to search, then they call a drug dog. There's no information if they do that as a matter. It would be alarming if they did that as a matter of practice if they didn't suspect there were contraband in the car when someone refuses consent.
Did the state even put in any testimony through Officer Rademacher or anyone else that having heard they're suspecting narcotics in a hotel room, normal police procedure would be to search a vehicle?
No, there's no information in the records like that. They simply, the investigation just kind of proceeds along. They had this phone call about a suspected substance, and then they just go in and it spirals from there.
So there's a gap there in terms of the record showing what is normal police procedure to proceed to a search of the vehicle.
Correct.
Okay.
One of the problems we have here is that everything proceeded along with the information that was learned as a result of these officers going into the motel. All the actions were pivoting off of that. And for our purposes, determining whether or not this independent source was inevitable discovery, we have to limit the record to what Rademacher knew before he went in. And one of the things he said, he didn't even know what he was going to find when he went in, based upon the limited information he was given by Patel.
Right. And given the high burden the state has to satisfy an inevitable discovery, this kind of speculation essentially means they have not met that burden. We don't know what police would have done if they hadn't done everything illegally up until the point they searched the car.
So you were in the process of telling us why the second part of prong one wasn't met. They didn't get a warrant for the apartment, for the motel room.
Yes, and essentially, assuming, I don't believe they had it, I think they did not have sufficient cause for any of it, but even assuming they had all the probable cause in the world, there's no evidence that these police officers go about applying for a search warrant to search a car. The state hasn't presented any evidence that they would actually have applied for a search warrant this time when they wanted to search a car, as opposed to when they wanted to search a home.
Jump ahead. After Shaw admits that the drugs in the tote bag belong to him, the drugs in the car belong to him, what did the police do?
After, just as an initial matter, I maintain that statement ought to be suppressed.
Understood.
At that point, once he claims responsibility for the marijuana in the car, he's arrested based on that statement. And then they go inform Hansen, the driver, about Shaw's statement.
Do they ask Hansen for consent, or is the record clear on what precisely takes place at that point?
At that point, they asked her repeatedly, or I think two or three times up until then.
Before,
and she'd refused each time. And when the officer communicates that Shaw has made this statement, then we get a signed consent form from her.
Do we know from the record, do they ask either a third or a fourth time for consent after Shaw's statement?
I believe they ask, the fourth time they ask is after Shaw has made the statement, and at that point she consents, or she signs a consent form.
Is there anything in the record about them speaking with supervisors or others about getting a warrant at that point?
No. The only discussion about search warrants comes in the context of if there is a refusal to consent, or if there is or based on the drug dog's alert, they apply for a search warrant under those circumstances. But the main investigating officer here testified that he'd never applied for a search warrant, and that he was not trained about telephonic warrants, and he didn't believe judges could issue warrants on Sundays. So on that record, it's a little bit unclear what the police actually would have done, and those gaps in the record make the state's claim of inevitable discovery impossible to sustain.
Was there enough, just with the lawful evidence that Rademacher had before he entered into the motel room, did he have a basis for detaining for 35 minutes Shaw?
No. The officer at that point had, if we take the information that he lawfully knew, it's that the driver has a municipal warrant and a traffic ticket, and there's a report of some unknown substance in her motel room. The officer testifies that
Did the defendant also misstate his name or mislead us to his name?
Not Shaw. Shaw was the first passenger interrogated after the driver. He provided his name. He was checked for warrants. He didn't have any warrants. And the officer testified that he had no connection to the motel, no known connection to the motel room. He was just being detained as part of this overarching investigation based on what they had found in the motel room. And so they lock him inside the back of a police car. And for all the reasons from my initial brief, this was an arrest, and there was certainly not probable cause, and I don't even believe there's reasonable suspicion sufficient to, if we want to call being locked in a police car an investigatory detention, there isn't reasonable suspicion for that.
How would you respond to the claim that the consent interrupted the flow, interrupted the police efforts midstream, and they would have proceeded to get a warrant?
I think that in another case, that could sustain, or that could be part of a state's showing that it's inevitable that a search warrant would have issued. But given the past actions in this case and the repeated failures by multiple police officers to get a warrant, just because they testify that it's their standard procedure to apply for a warrant, that can't overcome what the past of this investigation has demonstrated in this case. The state has to do more to show that these police officers, having previously done these unlawful activities, would have changed their practice and applied for a search warrant.
Is your basic argument that the illegal entry into the motel and what the officers learned from that illegal entry tainted everything, and it's impossible to, like, unthread the corrupted parts from what might be lawful?
I think in this particular case, yes, there's no way on the existing records to untangle this inevitable discovery argument from everything that happened.
Should we look at whether a particular warrant application would be standard procedure versus left to the discretion of police officers? By that I mean, you know, we know from the record that it was standard procedure following the dog sniff to seek the warrant. There obviously was a failure to seek a warrant just before the search of the motel room. Do we know whether that also was standard procedure? In other words, that an officer, it was standard procedure in the department, that if an officer is called in by a landlord, a motel manager, whoever the person may be, with suspected drugs, you must seek a warrant. I'm trying to see is, are they in the same standing as procedures in the department?
Presumably, and I would hope that police departments have policies to follow the Constitution, which would mean seeking a warrant before you enter someone's dwelling.
Obviously, in general, but for example, the standard procedure regarding the dog sniff is an effort to give more specific guidance than simply just follow the Constitution for the officers so they actually do things correctly. Do we know whether what the warrant they didn't seek was also on the same standing in the department in terms of it being part of a standard procedure to, and should we be concerned about that in looking and comparing what they didn't do versus what they did?
We don't have enough information about what their policy is with respect to the motel room. We have what they did, which is enter a dwelling without either probable cause or a warrant, and not just the responding officer, but he then called his supervisor, who also entered. So insofar as the core tenet of search and seizure law under our Constitution is once you have probable cause, get a warrant, the repeated violations of it kind of do taint or call into question any other policy to apply for a warrant that might exist.
Did Rademacher, before he entered into the motel room, based upon the limited information he had from Patel, have even probable cause to secure a warrant?
No, not without asking more questions or doing some more investigation. He just had a motel manager reporting that he found something. And that's,
well, that's a little more than that.
A suspected...
He found what he believed
to be a suspected
were drugs.
Matter. Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes. But that's not... That I don't believe that's probable cause, but if the officer believed it was probable cause, he should do a little more investigating, ask some more questions, and then apply for a search warrant and have a judge essentially check his work to see if a warrant, he could get a warrant for that motel room.
Address the notion that this car would have been inventoried at some point. We have the manager's tip, which would routinely cause the police to run a check on the renter, which they do, and they discover that Hansen has an outstanding warrant. Address the impoundment, the inventorying of the car.
So as an initial matter, there's no factual basis for an inventory search in this record. And there's, given that it's a municipal arrest warrant for Hansen, she, given that she was seeking a refund for her motel room, presumably she'd actually paid for the whole week, her car is parked in the motel room parking lot, lawfully parked. She's paid for a week. It's a municipal warrant. There's no reason for police to...
You're relying on State versus Ercolano?
Yes, and Slockbauer.
Slockbauer?
Yes.
And those cases say in a circumstance like this, the driver has to be given the opportunity to lawfully park the car?
Right, and yes. And in this case, the car was lawfully parked. And even if Hansen, even though Hansen was the only driver, it's lawfully parked. She's paid for a motel room. She presumably could sort out a municipal warrant relatively quickly. And on top of it, as this court recognized in Keaton, if the state's trying to claim an inventory search would have been conducted, they have to testify to that. They have to present evidence the police actually do impound cars and inventory them. And that's not present in this case. The only lawful way into this car that's proposed is this hypothetical search warrant.
Do we know when the canine was called? When it was called?
The dog was called, I believe, at 4 p.m. and arrived at 4:20.
And how long after the car, her name was given, the officers, the lookup occurs, and her car is stopped? How long after that?
So I believe the officer initially arrived at the motel room around 2:30 or 2:40.
2:34.
And
the warrant check is at 2:40.
Yes, the warrant check is at 2:40. And then I think the car returns about 45 minutes or so later. The officer leaves, comes back, and is waiting in the parking lot next door to the motel room.
About 3:45.
Yes, and then... And then the dog is called. We know that Shaw is the first passenger brought out of the car and placed in the police car after they check
him
for
the car. The car stopped around 3:45, 3:50. How soon after that does the dog get there?
The dog arrives at 4:20. So, again, I think with the first prong, I've explained my position that the state has to prove that police actually would have done the lawful action and applied for a warrant, which they failed to do here. Turning briefly to the second prong, there's an overarching problem with applying inevitable discovery in the context of search warrants, because the state essentially has to come into court and say that it's inevitable that a neutral detached magistrate would issue a warrant. And if police could save illegal searches simply by coming into court later and saying, look how much probable cause we had, of course we could have gotten a warrant, there'd be no reason to ask for warrants ever. So this court should be extremely careful when applying inevitable discovery in the context of search warrants.
Well, we've already said that, haven't we, in Slockbauer 2?
Yes.
Footnote 3?
Yes,
that?
This court has said it, and I would ask it to just keep it in mind, especially where the claim of inevitable discovery relies on a search warrant and is essentially relying on a neutral, detached magistrate doing something inevitably. And when the state's trying to make that kind of claim, it should only be the case where a court can say that reasonable minds can't differ about the amount of probable cause, among other things. There's other ways that we should be careful about search warrants, but specifically with the probable cause that's underlying this hypothetical search warrant, all reasonable judges should grant this hypothetical search warrant, and in this case, the state has not made that showing. There's simply not enough information to sustain this hypothetical search warrant that these police officers or theoretically would have gotten.
When you say that you're excluding from the equation evidence that was found inside the hotel room, are you not?
Yes, I'm excluding evidence from the motel room and Shaw's statement, because both of those must be suppressed.
Right. And yet, Officer Rademacher, when he testified, said, "I had some reasonable suspicion that something could have been afoot with the vehicle pertaining to Ms. Hansen driving the vehicle, knowing she was the owner or the person who rented room 126, and there had been crack cocaine found in that room." So when he's testifying, he's definitely bringing those two thoughts together in his explanation as to the suspicion that would have given rise to the need to search the vehicle.
Correct. He is not separating the motel, what he actually found in the motel room, from what he knew before entering.
That's why we're in this complete hypothetical sphere. And on the remand, no one testified to what they would have done under this new set of hypothetical facts.
Correct. There's no evidence of, state was given the opportunity to say, okay, let's say all you have is this tip. What happens?
I don't even see the remand court carving off the illegally secured evidence and only looking at the legal evidence and making determinations from it. Am I correct?
From my reading of the remand opinion, yes.
Anything you'd like to add?
Just with respect to the independent source doctrine, briefly, it doesn't apply here. It applies when there's two searches. The first is unlawful, the second is lawful. In that case, so long as the lawful search can be completely separated from the first unlawful search and there's no taint, there's no reason to suppress evidence. But here, we have one search of the car pursuant to plainly involuntary consent. So the car search is illegal, and we're left in the land of hypotheticals of what police would have done if they hadn't violated constitutional rights. And on this record, state has failed to satisfy that burden, and the evidence found in the car must be suppressed.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I think Ms. McLean has covered a lot of the ground I want to cover, so I'll try to be brief. When we try and figure out what it was police had in order to authorize the search of a car, absent what they found from the motel room, they claim there are three things. We've talked about two. It's worth talking about the third so I can illustrate how silly it is. But they say we had the tip, which I think is missing three critical things, which I'll talk about. They had the municipal arrest warrant, and they had the fact that based on this officer's training and experience, people from Florida in rental cars who go to motels are there for drug business. We can't simply allow officers to invoke the words training and experience and ignore the logic of it. People from Florida in rental cars staying in motels at the Jersey Shore for a week are also there for tourism. It simply can't be true. If that's true, then we've given police an end around to the Fourth Amendment, which is simply use the words training and experience without any logic. As to the tip, the court has really hit on this, but the tip is missing three critical things. It is missing anything about what kind of drugs we're talking about. And so there's this talk of, well, it could have been flour and it could have been sugar. I actually think that's the wrong description, because that's always true. If someone gave a very vivid description, I saw a white powdery substance, it appeared packaged like cocaine, it could still be flour until a field test, until it's gone to the lab. But the point is here, this could have been suspected marijuana, so it could have been oregano, it could have been marijuana, it could have been flour, it could have been cocaine. Those questions weren't asked. So you might have had the instance where what they had was a woman who had a joint in her room and a municipal arrest warrant for failure to appear on a traffic ticket. Hardly the crime of the century. And they didn't know because they didn't ask. And they also didn't develop it on remand, but they didn't ask in the first instance. What kind of drugs did you, what made you think it was drugs? Those questions weren't asked. So there's nothing about the type of drugs, there's nothing about the quantity of drugs, and there's nothing about a nexus to the car. If the state's theory is right, that a citizen informant saying there are drugs in a home automatically gets you into a car, then we've been doing this whole Fourth Amendment thing wrong for the last several years, because when judges issue search warrants, they don't say you get anything of this defendant's. They have to identify the specific place. And that's because homes are different from cars, are different from workplaces. And there's nothing to tie any of those three together in this case. A couple more quick points. I was troubled in the state's brief and in the officer's testimony that the officer testified that he, well, first of all, there's this illegal detention of the at least two and probably three members of the car. Obviously, they have a warrant for the driver. Bolden gets out first, and the police, with guns out, tell him to go back to the car. I don't think they had any basis to do that unless they had information from within the motel room. Again, right? She might have had a joint and a municipal warrant. Riding in a car with someone who once possessed marijuana and who has a municipal warrant does not raise any suspicion as to that person. So no authority to detain any of them. They then ask for names, and Justice Fernandez-Vina, I believe it was co-defendant Dickerson, gave a false name, but neither Shaw nor Bolden gave false names. They also didn't have to give names at all. Again, there's no suspicion. There's no basis upon which the state could demand their names. That is not authorized under our law. And so they could have said nothing.
Once they volunteer, if it's a false name.
Sure, and maybe that's applicable as to Dickerson. I think we could have a much more robust conversation if it were necessary about whether you volunteer after police at gunpoint send you back to the car. I think the idea of doing anything truly voluntary at that point is a little foreign. But Shaw didn't. He was held in the car. And then what the police say, and this is the other thing that troubled me, is they said, had he said, I want to leave, we wouldn't have let him take the bag unless we searched it. That's what their policy was. Their policy doesn't comport with the Constitution. They don't have probable cause to search the bag. Maybe they could pat it down for weapons, but a full-blown search of the bag, there's not the warrant, but there's also not even probable cause that there's anything in the bag, and there's no suspicion to hold this guy. And so this is a case where there are, I watched the last argument, I didn't participate in it, and in it the state seemed to be saying, listen, we didn't know that the search of the hotel room wasn't good because you hadn't decided right yet. And in the state's brief on remand, they talk a lot about first principles. So let's go back to first principles. First principles are a warrantless search of someone's home is illegal. In Wright, the state sought to get an exception to that. But until such an exception is granted to them, warrantless searches are presumptively illegal. So the status quo was that the search of this motel room violated the New Jersey Constitution. And that's that. And they should have known that. And they don't get to now. We've created this rule of inevitable discovery where we say we're going to relieve you of the harshness of the exclusionary rule, but we're going to make it difficult. We're going to impose this burden of clear and convincing evidence. It wasn't true on the record beforehand, which is why, over a dissent, this court remanded for an opportunity for them to build that record. And the record is exactly the same today as it was a year ago when this case was argued, and the state cannot shoulder its heavy burden. Unless the court has any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Murawski.
May it please the court. The inevitable discovery doctrine here was satisfied. All three prongs of it were satisfied. Taking it right from the beginning, the police had information from a face-to-face person that the officer knew by name, knew by face, who said he thought he saw drugs in the room. That's what he was told. Now, before he goes into the room, he gets a printout of the driver's license from the front desk, which he says is standard practice. And he also says with standard practice that they're going to check, when they have a complaint about a guest in a hotel, they check that whether that guest has any warrants. So now you have Mr. Patel's statement that he thought he saw drugs. You have the fact that there's an arrest warrant for this woman. And yes, you also have the fact that the officer sees that this is consistent with someone who is transporting drugs. You have someone who's demanding a refund. There's no testimony here that bed bugs were ever found. Instead, she tells them to go into the room to investigate the bed bugs, but they don't find bed bugs, they find drugs. So it's clear that the officers were going to stop this car. They were going to arrest that driver. There's no doubt that they would have done a warrant check. And now that car was now stopped. Now, to realistically think that the police were just going to leave the car parked in the parking lot with the owner's information, the fact that she had an arrest warrant, is unrealistic. This court should be clearly convinced that the police were going to continue their investigation. They decided to continue their investigation with a consent. First, and the consent was refused. And the officers testified, both officers testified, that if consent is refused, it's standard practice that they call for a drug dog.
Why wasn't the dog there when they got there?
Excuse me?
Why wasn't the dog there when they got there? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. Go ahead.
Well, who
Continue.
Got there?
Continue. I apologize. I apologize.
And there's a sergeant on the scene. And the sergeant on the scene gives his permission to go forward with this alternative to a consent search. It's clear this is an alternative. There's been consistent testimony by both officers from two different departments that when consent is refused, they call for a dog. If there's a positive dog sniff, they apply for a warrant. They would have applied for the warrant. It's clear and convincing in the record that this was part of their procedure. The sergeant was on scene. They would have done this. And that you had the probable cause from the positive dog sniff, and you would have brought back Mr. Patel's information that he saw drugs in the room, the fact that she had an arrest warrant, the fact that someone else in the car was lying about her identity and also had an arrest warrant, and the fact that in the officer's experience this is consistent with drug activity. And the remand judge who issues warrants as part of his job said this would have sustained a search warrant. So the state urges that under the inevitable discovery doctrine, which was the subject of the remand and the subject of this argument, was satisfied. And the state wants to be clear that we in no way abandon or concede any of our prior arguments. The police officer, at the time he did this, was not unreasonable to think that he had an appellate division opinion, a published appellate division opinion said, you can actually go into someone's home if the landlord invites you in. So the officer couldn't have been far off base when an owner and a proprietor of a motel invites the officer in. And there was no egregious conduct here on the part of the police. They were trying to follow procedure. Some of it later turned out to have maybe been not acceptable. But again, we want to emphasize this isn't a private home. This is a motel room. She was demanding a refund. Her interest in that motel room was going to cease as soon as those drugs were found. We ask this court not to apply the same standard for a private home as to a motel room. Of course, I don't want to rehash old arguments if the court prefer not to, so.
Are you done with your opening statement?
Yes.
Start with prong one. What is there in the record that tells us, by clear and convincing evidence, the police would have, not could have, but would have, obtained a warrant?
They said that when consent is refused, they ask for consent, that they ask for a drug dog.
So I think that argument would be stronger had there not been three refusals up until that point. How many times is it appropriate for the police to ask for consent?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, but the fact is they didn't get any fruit from those repeated requests. So they didn't get any fruit from those repeated requests, and then they probably figured they're not getting it. Maybe in their experience they figure that they'll more explain the situation or that they give the person time to think about it. But in any event, nothing was gained from those multiple requests. So they got a dog. They had already put in place the alternative to a consent search, which was call for the dog and see if there's a positive hit. They didn't just testify to that. They actually did that. Shows up, certified reliable drug dog, has a positive hit on the back of the car. Now, both officers testified it's standard procedure that if they don't get a consent, they call the dog is a positive alert, then they fill out an affidavit, they impound the car, and they apply for a search warrant.
So once the positive hit takes place, are any steps taken to fill out the affidavit? Are any steps taken to alert a supervisor that we may need to get a warrant today? It's Sunday. How do we go about doing this? Does anything happen other than going back for the fourth time to ask for consent?
Well, the circumstances were interrupted by the fact that Shaw actually at that point admitted that the drugs in the car were his. And at that point, the police took that information to the driver to give her full information as to what they had, and they gave her another opportunity to consent.
I understand all of that. Can you answer the question?
No, there was no affidavit was typed up because...
Was there a phone call or any effort at all?
No, the officers reasonably...
Toward getting to a warrant?
No, the officers reasonably thought now that they had the consent, they now no longer needed the alternative approach that they were going to take.
I'm talking about before asking again for consent.
Right. They asked for consent, and they figured that they got it. But had it been refused, this was all systems go to get an affidavit typed up in a car and pounded.
All right, let me go back to my question that I asked you much too early. The consent was refused. It took a half an hour to get the dog there. And during that half an hour, nobody did anything except wait for the dog and see if you can get consent once the dog gets there. Why wasn't, I guess what the point maybe he's making is nobody did anything in that half an hour, 35 minutes, to do anything about moving forward.
But they were waiting for the dog. They were waiting for
the
dog.
Yeah, I get you. And if the dog gets there, you're saying they would have applied for the search warrant, but they didn't have to because they got consent. Okay, you got a half an hour, nobody made a phone call, nobody did anything to start the ball rolling. And nobody's testifying they would have done anything to start the ball rolling.
Well, if they didn't get if the dog did not test positive, they may not have...
I guess.
But
I'm figuring that if they thought they had probable cause or reasonable basis at this point, they're thinking they're going to get a hit. I mean, why did they go through all this?
Well, I don't know if the police... The question is, why don't they get the ball rolling? I don't know if the police would have started to do all that work if... It would have been refused at that point to incorporate the dog sniff.
I'm sorry.
What would have been refused?
If the consent was refused and the dog sniff was negative, then what would have happened at that point?
That would have been it.
That probably would have been
nowhere
it at
to
that
go
point.
From there.
But it's clear that the police they waited for the dog, and in the meantime, in that half hour, I don't know if I would say nothing was happening. I think the patrolman Rademacher was dealing with the other passengers.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, why wasn't the dog, why did it take so long to get a dog there from the time that they saw the car, the time they did the lookup? Why wasn't that process already started?
It's not unusual for the police to rely on consent without bothering the drug dog. Drug dogs are not so plentiful where we could just call them on a...
I understand that.
So if they get a consent, they go with the consent. There's nothing wrong with that. If they get a lawful consent, they go with that, and they don't bother the dog. So they don't call the dog right away. They only call the dog when the need arises, when the consent is refused.
Three times.
So, yeah, I mean, at this point, maybe while they were waiting for the dog, they might have, they kept informing her what was going on. I mean, she saw what was going on in front of her. They were taking other people out of the car. One of them lied about her identity and also had an arrest warrant. So it's not like they were doing nothing during that time. They were dealing with the other passengers. So
assuming, did you finish? I'm sorry.
Yes, I did.
Assuming that what was found in the motel is out, because that was an unreasonable search, warrantless, illegal search, there's not a lot of information possessed by Rademacher other than a complete net opinion by a civilian whom he hasn't made any inquiry of concerning what he saw.
A civilian that he knows from sight and name,
but does,
and get the arrest warrant. The arrest warrant is a huge factor.
Okay, let's take out the arrest warrant, okay, because I want it in terms of like what he knows in terms of drugs. All he knows is he may know this person, Patel, but he doesn't know whether or not Patel knows how to identify narcotics, does he?
No, he doesn't know, but he's reasonable to infer that a motel owner could have some idea.
Okay. Well, okay, he doesn't ask him what the drugs look like, does he?
No.
He doesn't ask him what the quantity is.
No, because...
He doesn't ask him whether or not it's a roach, a marijuana cigarette.
Well, From what I understood, the testimony was a bag of suspected narcotics. So
where,
that
where
would
is
make
that?
More
where
the
is
approach.
That? Where
but
is that?
The officer didn't ask these questions because he thought under the third-party intervention doctrine
right.
he can go in.
That's precisely the issue. Yeah, he didn't ask those questions, so he thought he could go in. But if you're limited to the information he had, it wasn't that much.
Well,
it wouldn't have been, even been enough to get a warrant.
Well, it would have been enough to conduct an investigative detention of Hansen and her car. It certainly would have. And when you add the fact that there was an arrest warrant for her,
but
she was going nowhere and that car
would
was...
Would it have been enough to conduct an investigative detention of Shaw, who was just a passenger?
Shaw was with her. Shaw was with her. She had drugs in the hotel, as they do
What? You say drugs. What drugs? DP drugs? Any drugs? Flour? Sugar? We don't know. First of all,
nothing was found necessarily. If we extricate Shaw's statement and proceed to the inevitable discovery doctrine, then nothing was found as a result of Shaw's statement. Shaw's statement can be extricated from the entire. So the stop
how?
Of the statement.
Because it's after Shaw's statement that Hansen gives consent. She had three times refused consent when Shaw says, "Oh, the marijuana in that car is mine." That's when Hansen says, "Okay, I'll give you consent." Right? Do I have that wrong?
Right. But if we're proceeding to the inevitable discovery doctrine, we're excising Shaw's statement and Hansen's consent and proceeding as what would have been hypothetically done in the absence of those things.
In the absence of all of the illegal things that occurred and all of the fruits of the illegal things. We have to carve all that out.
Well,
before we consider independent source or inevitable discovery, correct?
Okay, again, I can't emphasize enough, we don't concede that it was illegal, but you do have stuff, even aside from the officer's conduct, you have Patel's statement given face-to-face to an officer he knows. You're talking about a proprietor of a motel. We're not talking about a random person on the street. A proprietor of a motel says he saw a bag of suspected drugs in this person's room. They ran a check. There was an arrest warrant for her. They were going to stop this car, and they were going to take investigative measures to see what was in that car, either through consent or the alternative through the dog. It's clear that with that information, it's still strong enough to have held the car and to pursue the investigation.
Well,
it's reasonable to think they would
think
have.
Think about Patel's actual statement. So we know that if the officer had gone on and asked the next question, since he just said suspected marijuana, what he would have told him was, and this is according to Patel's grand jury testimony, "I didn't know what it was, so I called the police. I wasn't sure it was drugs."
Well,
I mean, so had he gone on to ask Patel more questions, that's the answer presumably he would have gotten. Presumably, the officer would have asked questions about what he actually saw, but none of that occurred. None of that occurred because Rademacher thought he was able to go into the motel.
Well, he's also reasonable to believe that they saw something at the very least suspicious because they call the police, they tell them there's suspected narcotics in room 126, the owner tells them that he saw a bag of suspected narcotics. So he's being invited into that room by the proprietor of the motel. It's not a landlord of someone's private home, it's a proprietor of a motel. And he's invited into this motel, and at that time, so he didn't think, he thought that Patel could invite him into that motel room. It wasn't all that unreasonable. And the fact that the officer had an interim appellate division support for what he did shows that he was certainly not acting egregiously. He was certainly not acting with flagrant disregard for anybody's rights.
No, but assuming...
Well, that's independent source.
Assume all that's true. And he gets the call from the proprietor. Reason to believe there are drugs in the room. He knows the renter of the room. Knows there's a warrant for him. Let's assume all that's true. He's going to stop the car when it gets there. Okay? Assume all that's true, all that's appropriate, all that's legal. He's got nothing else. He doesn't have Shaw's statement. He's never been in the hotel room. All those things. Now he's going to stop the car, and now he's going to get the dog, and dog's on its way, whether she consents or not, and get the warrant. What do we have from the time they know of the warrant, they know the complaint, They see the car. What do we have from there until the ultimate search of the vehicle and the tote bag to tell us they would have applied for a warrant?
Well, there was time spent where Patrolman Rademacher called for backup because someone had tried to get out of the car.
Would have applied for the warrant. Just tell me how we get from assuming all that other stuff is in and you're right about all of it.
Okay.
The call, the warrant, the stop of the vehicle. We have no consent. We have no Shaw statement. Tell me why we should conclude, make that argument, that they would have applied for the warrant.
Because both officers testified credibly that when consent is refused, they call a drug dog, and if the drug dog makes a positive hit, it is their practice that they apply for a warrant. And there's no reason to think that now that they waited for this drug dog to arrive, that they were now going to disregard their departmental policies.
What about the testimony about this being a Sunday and the officer's understanding of that?
Well, by that time, Patrolman Rademacher's understanding of how you could get a warrant is not quite as important because now you have a sergeant on the scene. Now Officer Krepper shows up with the dog. So there's a lot of officers on the scene. So this one individual officer who's not the ranking officer on the scene, his opinion that they can't get a telephone
Where's
warrant
that
on Sunday is really a red herring.
Is it in the record that the sergeant said what steps they would have taken to get, did anybody say it beside Rademacher?
No, the sergeant didn't say what steps, but Rademacher and Krepper both testified that when a consent's refused, they get the dog.
Yeah,
there's nothing
Come back to what the chief said. Just answer that question. What do we have in the record? And I'm asking you. I don't remember off the top of my head. What do we have in the record from any officer, from anybody who testified, that this is what we do when consent's refused?
Yeah, we have a few things from Patrolman Rademacher.
We already have, you know, and the chief told you, he didn't even think he could get a warrant on a Sunday. He's credible. Certainly, I think the judge believed him when he said that.
Well,
what do we have in the record that gets us from point A to point B?
Officer Rademacher testified that the police officer would call for a drug detection canine, which is the next step in getting to the point of having to secure a search warrant. Then when Krepper testifies, he testifies, when a drug canine sniff is positive, the car is impounded and the police apply for a search warrant. And in his experience, the canine's alert is the main reasoning in the warrant for providing authorization for the search.
So your argument is that testimony, assuming we get to the point where they stop the vehicle and they ask for consent and it's refused, that testimony gets us to the point of inevitable discovery.
It does, and I'll explain that you have to look at burdens of proof and burdens of the evidentiary burdens that the state has at this point. The state's burden to prove overall is clear and convincing evidence, but the state only needs to prove the discrete factors and circumstances by a preponderance of the evidence. This court said that in State versus Sugar. Certainly, the consistent testimony of two officers that it's their policy that when consent's refused, we call for a dog, the dog positive alert, we type up an affidavit, impound the car, and get a search warrant. That meets the preponderance of the evidence standard to prove those discrete factors that lead up to proving the inevitable discovery doctrine by clear and convincing evidence. I mean, you're allowed to make reasonable inferences here. I mean, you don't need testimony saying, yes, I was in the process to going to headquarters and starting to type things up. I called my secretary and had him typing it up. You don't need that. It's clear that this was their policy. This was their procedure. There is no evidence in the record that they were, with the sergeant on scene, they were going to disregard their policy at this point, supposing that Hansen held firm to her refusal.
Can I ask you some procedural issues? Because this case has been going on a long time.
Yes.
Perhaps you can refresh my recollection. That with respect to the motel, the trial court suppressed the evidence in the motel?
No.
Or the appellate division? Okay.
Yeah.
Did the state appeal from that? And did you cross appeal from the suppression of the motel?
I don't believe so, from as far as that order is concerned, but that issue is still relevant to the extent it sheds light on the evidence.
That's why I'm asking. So the issue about the motel, the suppression, that issue was never petitioned to the court. So that issue is not before us, correct?
Not expressly in that regard, but it's still part of the case.
Well, the part that remains is part of the case. The part that wasn't suppressed is part of the case. But the part that was suppressed is not part of the case, correct?
Well, the ultimate issue now is what was found in the car, because we have to remember the only remaining defendant
I'm just dealing with the motel room. Everything in the motel room is out. Do you agree?
Well, no. Our position had been all along that Shaw can't complain about that because Hansen, the motel guest, is out of the case. She was never part of the appeal. And it was her hotel room.
The appellate division, in Shaw's case, tell me if I'm mistaken, in Shaw's case, the appellate division suppressed all the evidence in the motel room.
I don't know if they did suppress all the, I know that they found the consent and Shaw's statement to be improper. I don't know what they did with the hotel evidence, actually. I forget.
I think they said it was invalid under Wright.
Under Wright, but of course Wright was after.
Yeah, but you haven't, the point I'm trying to establish or find out is whether or not the state appealed that piece, and the state apparently hasn't appealed that piece. You've appealed other decisions made, so we have to accept that everything in the motel is out for our purposes.
Well, certainly not the statement from Mr. Patel.
No, of course not. I'm talking about everything after Rademacher entered the motel.
Right, and we would ask the court that if that's the procedural posture of the case, then you don't need to make a ruling on it. If you, because the state feels strongly that a motel patron, especially under these circumstances, does not have the same expectations of privacy as the.
But you haven't appealed. That's
yeah,
not an issue.
Right, but we don't. This court doesn't have to make an authoritative statement on that. Is what I'm saying.
No, we don't have to.
Okay.
But for our purposes. I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Because that issue is not before, so we shouldn't be touching it. But all we should be considering is the information that Rademacher had before he went into the motel.
Including
correct?
The warrant.
So maybe you can respond to one of my concerns. In the remand, I didn't see anyone pivoting off a hypothetical of, like, what would you have done just based upon the information that Rademacher had before he went into the hotel. And it seems to me that every decision thereafter bears upon that question. Am I mistaken?
Well, it seems reasonable inferences can be drawn. We all know what police do in reaction to the circumstances they face. They were going to check the warrant. They were going to check for her warrant. They were going to know she had an arrest warrant. They were going to know that a reliable informant, face-to-face informant, said he thought he saw drugs. And so that car was stopped, that car wasn't going anywhere, and the police had at least reasonable suspicion to suspect that drugs could be in the car.
See, that's the problem. Would they have had a reasonable suspicion based upon only the information that Rademacher had? And would that have been enough to detain Shaw?
But the detention of Shaw, if we look at the inevitable discovery aspect, as far as the dog sniff and the search warrants concerned, the detention of Shaw is irrelevant, really. Shaw's statement does not factor into that inevitable discovery discussion. In my inevitable discovery discussion on the remand brief, I don't use Shaw's statement. I know that the remand judge did, but I don't use it. The dog sniff itself is very powerful, could almost by itself be probable cause, but you could bring in Mr. Patel's statement again, you could bring in her arrest warrant, now you have a lying passenger.
This is what we don't know. Maybe if a question had been asked on the remand, we'd know the answer. Based upon the limited information that Rademacher had, would they have called in a drug dog? Sure, they were going to call a drug dog in after they found mounds and mounds of drugs in the motel room. But based upon suspected narcotics, not even knowing what it was, whether or not it was a small amount of marijuana?
The state would urge that the appropriate question is not based on what he knew, is based on the refusal of consent. The testimony is when consent is refused, they call for a drug dog. So it's not...
Even without any level of suspicion?
Well...
When consent is refused, I mean, there are situations without anything close to probable cause where they ask for consent.
Well, you certainly, as this court said in Cardi, you need a reasonable suspicion to ask for the consent.
Right. Right. So you're assuming, when you say that, that their policy is that you wouldn't be asking for consent without the reasonable suspicion.
In a car situation. And here you had Patel's reliable statement. There was an arrest warrant for her.
But that, the arrest warrant is going to give you a reasonable and articulable suspicion to believe that there are drugs in the car. Do you agree?
The arrest warrant will help color these.
What was the arrest warrant for?
We don't know, but arrest warrant. Okay. Not everybody drives around with an arrest warrant. It's very suspicious.
Okay, so if the arrest warrant was failure to pay a ticket, you would agree. That's not going to give you a reasonable and articulable suspicion to believe that there are drugs in the car, correct?
If that was, in fact, the reason, but...
So then the only remaining thing in terms of reasonable and articulable suspicion, this is pivoting off of Justice Patterson, is whether or not Patel's comment to Rademacher, I think there may be suspected narcotics in the room, would have been reasonable and articulable suspicion without knowing anything more that there were drugs in the car.
It would have been indeed, because if you look at other cases like Basil, a witness goes up to a police officer and says, that guy has a gun. He threw it under the car. I mean, I saw drugs. I saw a suspected bag of drugs.
Well, the difference in that hypothetical is people know what a gun is. Even Patel was saying he doesn't necessarily know what narcotics looks
like. Okay, but you don't have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The police don't have to be certain. They just need reasonable, articulable suspicion. It's a very low standard. And when you have someone you know who's a business proprietor and owner that you've known and you've dealt with, and he tells you, I found suspected drugs in there, that is a reasonable suspicion that there's drugs in that room. And when you attach it to the warrant and the officer's experience, the officer's conduct from there flowed even without his confirmatory observations in there. Reasonable suspicion is not a high standard. It's a very low standard, and he also gave his statement based on personal knowledge. It wasn't a rumor. He said, I saw it. That enhances its reliability. The officer knows him. He's not an anonymous informant. He's a known informant. He's also a proprietor of a business. This court has accepted cases that say responsible citizens, concerned citizens, have a higher degree of reliability than just an anonymous source or a source from the underworld. He was a respected business owner that he knew. So you have those factors that are enhancing this statement. It's not just a random statement from a nameless, faceless person that there's drugs there. You have to look at the source of that statement. And the source of that statement in this case adds significant reliability to that statement and the officer's reasonableness in relying on it. And then when you get the arrest warrant, it confirms that there's a problem here and
Mr.
we need
Mirowski,
to investigate.
But all of that goes to the information that Mr. Patel was trying to convey about what was believed to be in the room. How do you make the leap then to the reasonable, articulable suspicion giving rise to probable cause ultimately to search the car? Because we have Rademacher's statement in the record which ties the contents of the hotel room to giving rise to his suspicion of the vehicle. What else other than this assertion of training and experience that there likely was drugs in this car that was rented that gives rise to this inference?
Well, it's reasonable to think that someone who has an arrest warrant, they're going to be arrested, they have legal narcotics in their car and...
In their room,
that they also have a quantity in that car. At least reasonable, not... Probable cause would be a tougher case, but certainly reasonable suspicion to stop the car. It's a very low standard. And to think that one who has drugs in their hotel room, there's a good chance they have some drugs in their car.
So anytime somebody is found with drugs in their motel room, a car on the road can be stopped and searched.
If they have an arrest warrant, I would think that's enough reasonable to take.
Even if it's less
traffic.
Than 25 grams of marijuana?
Yeah, but we have to know what the officer knows. Now, maybe if this court, you know, obviously it's always better to ask more questions, but the information he had from a reliable source that he knew, I saw a bag of drugs in there. The officer was reasonable to use that information to learn that there was an arrest warrant. He was reasonable to use that information to stop that car, arrest that driver immediately, and to investigate the passengers as well. You're allowed to ask questions of passengers during a traffic stop. We know that.
You also know she came from Florida. and had a rental vehicle. I mean, he knew that much.
I mean, it certainly adds. I mean, we're not saying that alone means you could arrest somebody, but it certainly adds to the context.
No, at least if there are, you have the complaint that I saw something that looked like drugs in the room. They obviously got there from someplace. She's not a local resident. She's renting the hotel room for a week. I mean, you're arguing it's not a huge leap to say we have a reasonable basis to take a look at the car.
Sure, and it's
and you're not, I take it you're not relying on anything that was seen in the hotel room. You're relying solely on, and this depends on our view of, what the motel manager said, what the police officer did from there, which is look up the arrest warrant, and then the ordering of the dog, those three things in the time that they were done as your basis for the further action that
correct.
You would have gotten a search.
Correct. In response to this, to the evolving circumstances that they were facing. Those are reasonable procedures to take in response to those evolving circumstances. And it was reasonable to wait to call for the drug dog. You don't call a drug dog right away. That could be very inefficient.
I think we have your position on this. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Only to say that the state still adheres to all the positions in our prior briefs, and that we ask the court to find that the search of the car and the evidence against Mr. Shaw, who is the only remaining defendant in this case, is admissible.
Thank you. Ms. McLean? Thank you. We'll take the matter under